Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ja, velkommen til nok en podcast. Det sommer og sol, og min podcastmakker, han har tatt med seg en dyr luksusbil og dratt over fjellet. Så jeg sitter her i studio nå med min fantastiske produsent, Caroline Elgesem, og skal lede dere inn i en lang prat med Ed Sheeran. For... Det alltid Top Gear som den første tingen folk driver og snakker om når de skal snakke om bilprogrammer, men så viser det seg at Wheelie Dealers, det ofte det programmet som får folk litt i gang med prosjekter og drømmer, hvor konseptet alltid har vært å kjøpe noe, en bil billig med litt feil og fikse noe på, eventuelt på holden eller selge med en profit. Det har fått et program som fikk meg i gang med å tørre å skru og eie bil. Da jeg skulle kjøpe min første bil, så mente min far at ja, men en liten Skoda, de det jo aldri noe galt med. Og det har aldri vært et praktisk menneske, så det ble jo en gammel BMW 5-serie i stedet for, som jeg haltet frem og tilbake til biltema for å kjøpe stadig mer verktøy for å holde liv i. Så, og det har alltid vært greit da, å kunne lene seg på et bilprogram som Wheelie Dealers. Det begynte jo enkelt med biler til a grand, altså 1000 pund. Og derfra så har det jo rullet av gårde nedover og blitt dyrere og mer komplekse prosjekter. Men det er alltid morsomt å se også de gamle programmene, og det er jo relativt tidløse ting. Selv om det er relativt vanskelig å få tak i en del av de bilene fra de første sesongene til de fantastisk lave prisene som de ruller inn i garasjen med. Det for øvrig et intervju som vi har gjort per telefon. Telefonintervjuer har jo noen små problemer i at man mangler mimikk og den naturlige atmosfæren som blir når man deler bord og ansiktsuttrykk. Det bærer nok dette intervjuet kanskje bitte litt preget. Vi har som mål at på sikt så skal vi få Ed Sheeran inn i studio her, for det var den opprinnelige planen. Men det fordrer både at koronasituasjonen er under kontroll og at mannen er i Norge igjen. Noe han jo er med tid og stunder. Vi skal også i gang med gjester i studio etter sommeren, og det gleder vi oss veldig til. Men da er vi også avhengig av å få noen solide tips på hvem dere ønsker at vi skal komme i prat med. Det er en idé å foreslå navn som har en genuin bilinteresse eller gode bilhistorier. Det at en kjendis har en tøff bil gitt til dem av et importørledd, det kvalifiserer ofte ikke til de dypeste og gode samtalene, og alle vet jo at mil etter mil, en podcast om bil, det handler kun om de dype og gode samtalene. Men har du et tips til navn, mil etter mil at finansavisen.no eller vår Facebook-gruppe Finansavisen Motor. Med det så ønsker jeg velkommen til denne praten med Ed Sheeran.
So, I've read your book. I reckon you've read your book, but what are you up to these days? Why did you write a book, and what are you doing?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting time. You know, so I had a bit of time on my hands, and then weirdly, just coincidence. I got to do loads of stuff that we just couldn't do when we were filming all the time, you know, because the filming was pretty full on, you know, it was sort of, you know, all the time, really, actually. Even weekends, you were sort of travelling to a location often. So we wanted to go back here. I was going off and doing sort of setting British records in amphibious vehicles and all kinds of other mad stuff. Looking after my mum for a bit and got a bits and pieces. But then Virgin or Hebrew came and said, oh, do you want to write a book? And I was like, well, I don't know. But I've done one of those before. And so we sort of started out on the process. And I wasn't sure whether it was going to be a painful thing or not, but actually it was amazingly sort of cathartic, I guess. And then you kind of have all those little moments where you worry about, you know, whether those stories are interesting or not. And then you kind of realize some of the anecdotes you've been talking about for years are actually really rubbish. And so I'd never see the light of day again. So it's actually a really, really interesting process. And then, of course, also part of that was trying to find photos and then sort of just almost like traveling back in your mind to these earlier times. It was a really, really great sort of project, if you like, and sort of working with Imogen to actually, you know, to go through it all. I mean, so I have read it a number of times. In fact, we even read it out loud for the for the downloads you can get. So it was quite an immersive experience, but it was really wonderful. I'd love to do another one, actually, because I think now we've kind of got into the groove of it. Initially, it was very difficult to know where to start. We had a bit of help, you know, from the publishers as to how that would work, and then to work out a structure. And then once you kind of, in the end, it was just literally just the title of a chapter was enough to set me off. And so some of the madness at the very end of the book, you know, it was a very edited, stream of consciousness, I suppose.
Because I read the book, and we're going to give away one of we got two copies from your wife, and we're going to give one of them away to our listeners. But I've read the book, and it's a fascinating tale about how you ended up where you did. Because at least for a lot of our Norwegian listeners, you're primarily known for Wheelie Dealers and being sent on the Norwegian Discovery Network for years. But you've had quite an interesting career before that, and how you ended up doing all the stuff you did. But where did the curiosity for like building and repairing and making stuff come from?
Well, I guess probably in a weird way, my dad, and he was an actual rocket scientist. He worked on the world or the UK's first solar-powered satellite, among other things. And I never quite reached his accolades, if you like, but. It was, you know, obviously I have, there's other people in the family, I think, who have sort of been inventive in the past. And my grandfather was a head entomologist for the British Museum, I think. And so there's all this kind of logical, creative kind of spaces, you know, sort of in the genes, if you like. And I think I just find it really, I just love how stuff works, like understanding how things work or figuring out how stuff should work, perhaps. And so as a kid, I used to take things apart and then eventually I sort of put it back together again, as an interest in, I guess, the relationships between all kinds of bits and pieces. So it's really that. It's like how things go together. And that's not just mechanical things. It's kind of like how the world works. How does one thing influence another? And I think, certainly at school, I found it would be a lot of subjects at school in the UK. And you sort of have to pick a few and you go through the, as you get older. And I sort of discovered, you know, we did design and technology and woodwork and metalwork and all that kind of stuff. But I just really love the immediacy of actually making something with your hands. So I also used to do a lot of programming back in the day. So I stopped just before I might have made any money out of that. But, you know, it's the same sort of thing, you know, whether you're pushing around in a computer or whether you're sort of flying off an edge of a bit of metal. There's something in the creation of stuff, and I think that's really what I love the most. Is you know, I'm in sort of constantly curious, so I think everybody should always stay curious because obviously you learn something one way or the other. But I think it's putting all that together, and then once you've understood something, it's how can you apply that to something else? And I guess that's how we end up with driving furniture and stuff.
So, are you still building and inventing stuff, or is that a thing of the past?
No, absolutely. It's almost more so now than ever. I mean, I think, you know, whether it's little things around the house, but actually for the last couple of years, one of the things I've been working on, you know, it seems constantly, but it's, you know, sort of bits and pieces, we did a world record, or that was a world record attempt, actually, for the world's fastest electric ice cream van. So long story, but we've done stuff with Guinness World Records over the years. It started with the sofa, actually. We did 87 miles an hour on a racetrack, at Bonson Racetrack in the UK for a Sun newspaper piece millions of years ago. And then Guinness came out and said, well, that's a record. You know, are you interested? And it was like, absolutely, because obviously as a kid growing up, Guinness World Records, you know, a really, really interesting thing. It was the TV show Norris McWorth or the Twins, in fact, back in the day. And so it was almost like a dream come true in some respects. And so then once you've got one, you then have to do more. And then sort of speed forward to you know, a couple of years ago, they were saying, well, what should we do next? And so we had this idea of doing an ice cream van and making it electric, because I think that's definitely the future. And then I realised that it was almost more than me initially, was the fact that this is a real problem. You know, for years in the UK, back since the 60s, people have had to put up with diesel fumes, you know, when they're ordering their ice cream. And you just think, well, when it's outside a playground, you know, or outside a kid's school or whatever, that's not a good thing. And we shouldn't have to put up with that. And so then as part of, once I'd electrified the van, it was a brand new Mercedes, once I'd electrified that, then I suddenly realised I had to actually electrify the ice cream or the soft ice machine itself. And that proved to be quite tricky because they use a lot of energy to turn the liquid into ice cream almost instantaneously. So, you know, it sort of took a couple of goes and then sort of got it working well enough for the record attempt. And then I've sort of been honing it since. I've now got a kit, you know, possibly like a retrofittable kit that you can go into any ice cream van so that you can actually then run it on electricity, on batteries only, and not have to have the diesel thing running. So it can still drive there under whatever, you know, even if it's steam powered, it's not a problem. But then obviously once it gets there, you could serve all day, you need to serve a day's worth of ice cream using electricity. And it's sort of, in this country, local councils started banning ice cream vans last year, you know, because of the diesel fumes, and now we can fix it. So that's probably the most finished product I think I've ever invented, if you like. And it's now available effectively to sell. So, you know, we're working with various customers to get that in ready. Normally their season sort of finishes at the end of the year. Of course, this year has been a bit strange for everybody, I guess, but particularly ice cream sellers as well, because there's nobody to sell ice cream to. So we're hoping that it's really going to kick off next year. But I think really what I find with inventing is when, you know, when we're all inventive in some way or other. And what I find is when I'm trying to solve a problem, I end up having to solve, you know, I end up solving loads of other ones because I'm sort of not thinking about them so specifically. And so I find that the more I get creative, the more creative I get, if that makes sense. So it's sort of, and then recently I've just done, you can read a bit more about the ice cream van on my new website, which I just sort of put up the other day, you know, eggchina.com. And it was the same thing. Something I'd been putting off for ages. I could have got someone else to do it. And I thought, I'm just going to sit down and actually have a go. And it's obviously dead easy, but it's that kind of, it's, you know, sometimes you just have to get over that little mental block. And I think that stands for everything, whether it's in the workshop, in the garden, wherever you are. You know, some things are sometimes intimidating for no reason at all. And it's just a case of just pushing through, and then you'll be really, hopefully, enjoy the result.
So you're talking about electrification of an ice cream van. So as you're quite familiar with Norway, I guess. So,
yeah.
So electric cars are selling in huge numbers in Norway, and I think we have the largest percentage of electric cars per capita in the world right now. It's us, so California.
That's amazing.
What do you think about battery electric cars?
I think it's absolutely the future. I think it's really interesting. Actually, when I first started coming to Norway, it was back in the day where you still had a few old American vehicles floating around, you know, and sort of the cars were sort of often older, it seemed, you know, and then sort of over the years, obviously, that your car park, if you want to call it that, has got sort of better and better and better. And to see so many electric cars, I know you had the Think and the Buddy, and they were, and it's a shame that sort of neither of them have really sort of found their feet, but of course, they've been overtaken by the Tesla, and then that is an insane bit of engineering. In fact, the other day we had a go on it was when they're super sporty mode, and it was just, you know, it's like you can feel your brain or all the liquid in your head go to the back of your head. It's quite an amazing sort of experience, and it's a really nice party trick. But of course, obviously, that's not what really it's all about. But I mean, the interesting stuff, and we've got sort of charging points at the house, and so we can like 22 kilowatts, whatever. So we can actually you know, have electric cars up here because we needed one for the ice cream van. And what's amazing about it, when you think about it, especially for classic cars as well, and I'm working on a couple of projects where we're going to convert classics to run on electric, because there are lots and lots of classics that are, you know, fantastically stylish, really lovely to look at and whatever, but they, you know, it was never really about the engine. And obviously, there's plenty that are, but there's also things like the Citroen DS, for example. I mean, it's a beautiful car. And it was never about the engine. And so to make that electric would just make it even better. And if you can give it a sensible, you know, you normally won't travel for massive distance, but nowadays, as for every year, as battery technology gets better and gets cheaper, you can obviously afford to go further in whichever car conversion or, you know, sort of vehicle you're in. So I think the idea that, you know, you can have your car in winter in the garage, you know, sort of all winter, and then literally come out one day, nice sunny day, and of course, obviously, if you've got solar panels on your roof or whatever it is, you could literally have charged your classic, you know, over the winter, and it's ready to go. And every time you come back, and we have an electric boat, same thing. So, you know, you don't have a day's fun, come back, plug it in, the next time you want to use it, it's ready to go, no hassle with fuel or anything. So just purely from the enjoyment and practicality, it's the way forward. But also, you know, we do need to worry about the planet, and that's, you know, it seems to me a really obvious thing. You know, the planet is solar powered, so why not have all of our stuff solar powered too, and including buildings? But that's a whole other story, I guess. But certainly, I'm very much up for the idea of battery electric vehicles, and it's definitely, you know, part of the future. But also, hydrogen is going to be part of that mix, because I mean, we have one of my cars is a Range Rover, you know, it's not very environmentally friendly at all, frankly. You know, so the diesel fumes, you know, are not great. And I'm going to do some little tweaks on that to try and make it a bit better while I still have to put up with that. But if I'm going to tow something around the country, at the moment, there isn't an electric car out there, really, unless I make one myself, it's going to be up to the job with the right range pulling that kind of weight. So we've got, you know, they're early days. But I think I think it's easily solved with the hydrogen, which, again, can be made from solar power or whatever, or renewable energy anyway. So I think it's really exciting times. And right now there's all kinds of people having a go at solving, you know, all the same problems in lots of different ways. So it's exciting to see, you know, what's going to work, what's not going to work, and, you know, sort of where we're going to end up.
You're touching on something that's dear to my heart, and that's old Range Rovers. Firstly, what kind of Range Rovers are you talking about?
So I've got it's a later one. It's a 2006. I've actually got two. I've got a matching pair. One's completely broken, and one's mostly working.
Yeah, so that's
the way I see it. That's how you have to do that.
That's the L322 model, right?
Yeah. So it's a 2V6. So it's a great towing vehicle. It's the first Range Rover I felt that actually went as well as it sounded, because they always sounded pretty good, but they never sort of went anywhere. But this one really does, and it's got a sporty exhaust on it, so I haven't done anything to the engine particularly, but it's just somehow, you know, that much better. I mean, the 4.4 is even better still, but, you know, it's also slightly less economical perhaps, but yeah, they're good fun.
Yeah, because on a personal note, I've had four of those, and I have a secret dream of electrifying an L322. Do you think that's viable to do at all?
Well, I'll let you know, because actually that's one of my next coming plans. Because basically, I had this Range Rover. We bought it years ago, and in fact, the first thing we did actually, we bought it from a dealer, we got a few things wrong with it. We got it sorted, and then drove straight to Norway. So we drove all the way, and then we drove from Oslo to Bergen over the top. You know, sort of through the mountains with garage doors in and all that kind of stuff, and it was all very exciting. And they're kind of unstoppable with the right tyres. It's a fantastic thing, but I didn't quite make it to 250,000 miles. I only did 240,000, and both head gaskets blew. So it's I just literally picked it up yesterday from some friends of ours who were just going to do some work on it, just because I hadn't got the time, and they literally gave up. Ultimately, they just said, like, you know what, take it back. So I thought, well, maybe we should make it electric to see what happens. And it's actually all in bits. I've got the engine and box and the subframe all out, and then the rest of it sort of, you know, is looking quite forlorn at the moment. But it's really easy to see how it could work quite nicely, because if you stick a motor onto the transfer box, you can get rid of the gearbox, get rid of the engine, and then you can use that space for batteries. And so you can keep the weight of the vehicle about right, you know, the weight distribution. And so I think, so watch this space. I'm hoping or maybe do a little bit of YouTube stuff about that, and just, you know, do some sort of just, I don't know, like a diary, I guess, of sorts, just to follow how, you know, the trials and tribulations. And obviously, one of the things we had a problem with with the ice cream van was the CAN bus and stuff. So obviously, because it's a modern car, it's got all this electronics on it. It's got the brain talking to all the other devices on the vehicle. And if you take those bits away, it starts to have a bit of a panic. And so one of the things we're going to have to get on top of very early on is making sure that we've got, you know, sort of CAN communication working so that even if we've taken a part out, you know, the car still thinks everything's okay. So it's going to be an interesting time.
I'm definitely going to subscribe to that YouTube channel. But are you planning to do more YouTube stuff? Because you started up a project a couple of years ago where you did the rebuild of the Golf, but then it's not been that many projects on online. What are your plans for the future?
We started on YouTube a long time ago, but literally we had to send a video to someone in Australia and it was going to take too long to send a DVD, and there's this brand new technology called YouTube. And, let's give that a go. So we kind of set up the account and put up a video and didn't get the job, but then, you know, sort of carried on. And then like 7 years later, whatever it was, we started noticing that there were lots of people sort of subscribing and there was nothing for them to look at. So we kind of put up a few more videos, and of course I did the announcement and stuff from there. And then we sort of we've been trying out a few different bits and pieces, and we've done a couple of adverts, the corporate stuff and whatever, and did lots of Ask Ed videos and things, and sort of just trying to get a feel for what people actually want. But I think the overriding result is everybody wants me to keep fixing stuff and explain how stuff works. So that's what we're going to try and do. And so we're just putting the last bits and pieces together to try and do more regularly. I mean, I've been pretty rubbish, frankly, so apologies to all the listeners. We've been pretty bad at putting stuff up regularly. But what the idea is, we're going to be a bit more regular with things. We're going to sort of do a number of different sort of projects, just like you would, you know, in the garage. You know, you sort of tinker with this and fix that and whatever, and have some overriding stuff. So there's going to be some familiar projects that, you know, we sort of started before, and some other stuff and that's completely new, and then some really random things that might not even be to do with inside the workshop, but, you know, it could be just, you know, doing something for the missus or whatever, because we all have to do that too. So it should be quite a lot of fun. And the nice thing about YouTube is that it's the immediacy of the audience, the fact that everybody can comment on how good or rubbish your offering is, and then you can ask questions and you get answers back and whatever. And also we can, if we're playing with a new widget or a new tool or something, then we can talk about it, you know, in the description, so people can find it more easily. So it answers a lot of the questions that were brought up with the show before, you know, where people, because there was such a distance between when we actually did the work and when it was sort of published, if you like, on the network. That was one thing. But also, you know, we often weren't allowed to talk about some of the products or the stuff that we were using in there for those reasons. Whereas YouTube, we can do all of that. So that should be quite exciting. And I'm hoping that, you know, the audience would appreciate that.
Well, you have 31 videos and almost 500,000 subscribers. So I think there's a hole to be filled with Ed China stuff.
I think you're right. I have an obligation.
It feels like that. We actually posted on our Facebook group what people wanted me to ask you. And a lot of it was, when are you going to post stuff online again? Because they really miss the stuff you're doing. So...
sometime soon. I mean, literally, I'm hoping it's going to be within a couple of months if we get our stuff together. I mean, we've had a lot of things to deal with, I'm sure, as everybody has, with this craziness with the virus and things. But I think we're sort of getting back on track, and so we're sort of heading towards that, which is great. So, you know, and I think, and again, we're open to ideas. I mean, the Garage Revival show that we did, or the pilot we did, was on YouTube. I mean, we still want to pursue that at some point, but it's, because that was quite good fun, but it's obviously complicated, and it's a bigger thing, so that might be big TV, but YouTube is a really exciting place to play with, I think, so we'll see how we go.
Going on your YouTube channel, and you have a website called greasejunkie.com, which is also the title of your book. I saw you're selling, among other things, long orange gloves, and that reminds me of you were always repairing and making stuff wearing gloves. Whereas if you're on YouTube and you see people telling people how to repair and do stuff, they're always doing stuff without gloves. Why are you why are you always doing stuff with gloves on?
Yeah, well, it started a long time ago, actually. We were just, been to the doctors and we'd had a blood test or whatever it was, and he kind of said, oh, actually, you know what, there's an awful lot of hydrocarbons in your blood or whatever. And it's like, well, that didn't sound good. And he kind of went through and showed us all the various different bits and pieces, and just thought that really, is not healthy. And so, you know, because when you're young, I guess, you know, you're invincible and you don't really care about it. But obviously, I guess we've got to the stage where at least we could be vaguely sensible. So I just thought, well, you know what, out of principle. And also, again, as part of the thing about doing TV stuff is you worry sometimes that, you know, they always say, don't try this at home. You know, like, well, actually, you should at least wear gloves and stuff, or, you know, look after yourself. And we meet an awful lot of mechanics and people who play with cars, and they've got their hands are in terrible state, and you know, and it can get out of control quite easily. So I looked around for some gloves, and I sort of started wearing them. I forgot what series it was. And then I realized that actually the ones I had were a bit too sort of short. So I started looking for the bigger ones, and obviously found these orange ones. And I thought, well, that's the one for us then, sort of thing. So it all kind of came together at the same time. And that's why I've been wearing them ever since, because, you know, when you're playing with a car, you do mess around with a lot of nasty chemicals. When it's constant, obviously that was, you know, I was doing that all day long, you know, every day. You can see that it doesn't do your skin any good at all. And so it just makes sense to kind of put up a protection, not like a barrier between you and that. And also, you know, and the number of times that I've got away with stuff, a slipped angle grinder or whatever. And even though the gloves aren't designed to protect you from that, you know, that little extra layer sometimes makes all the difference. So it's something that, you know, I try to do all the time if I can. And then, of course, obviously, because people asked about it, so then we were selling them. So that makes sense, and still do to this day. So it's sort of that we've changed the world. Actually, there's an awful lot more orange gloves available now thanks to the show.
That actually drives me back to the point about electrification of cars, because chemicals, batteries, working on stuff yourself, how do you keep safe and working with battery stuff? Is that because...
Yeah,
because right
now... You have to be super safe. I mean,
No, I'm just thinking, because right now it's not that difficult to like work on an old car with a 4 or 6 cylinder engine and stuff like that. But in the future, we are hoping that people will continue repairing cars and building stuff. But it's going to be a different world when you have to do all the, as you were saying, the canvas stuff and the all of the electronics and the batteries and everything. How do you keep safe and how do you do stuff like that? How do you transition from the old mechanical world to the new battery world and still be enthusiastic about it?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I think it is definitely a challenge. I mean, I've certainly had a pretty vertical learning curve over the last couple of years, because I seem to keep trying new stuff. So like, once you've just worked out how to program a like the motor controller or the inverter, you know, for the motor, then you have to go and do the same thing for the battery monitoring system, for the battery pack and all this kind of stuff. And obviously anything over about 60 volts can kill you. And most electric stuff, so like a lot of the stuff on the OEM things are sort of like 400, 800 volts, that kind of thing. So you've got to be, you know, so it'll absolutely kill you. And in fact, there's a little, a slightly scary thing going on in the States where they mostly play around with the sort of around 150 volts-ish or thereabouts. And there's this perception that it's actually okay and it's kind of safe. And it's like, but it really isn't. So you just have to, I guess, be very careful. I mean, you really shouldn't be working on stuff like that on your own, for one thing. And you should always have someone else there just in case there's an issue. And there's lots of extra sort of PPE stuff that you're supposed to have. I mean, like just having special spanners and stuff that are all insulated, and having, you have to like the shepherd's crook sort of thing, so that somebody else can pull you away from electricity if there's a, if you get it wrong. And there's lots of other guidelines. But it's the same thing, you know, you wouldn't stick your hand into a spinning supercharger on a big V8 or whatever, you know what I mean? So, you know, and you wouldn't necessarily try and put a cigarette out in a load of petrol. So it's that kind of, you know, there's a little bit of common sense, or even a lot of common sense that needs to be used. But I think as far as the transition's concerned, it's just really like learning another skill. So just like when you start learning panel beating or you start learning how to paint a car. I mean, obviously, again, when I was a kid, it was always a perception that, or growing up at least, that cellulose paint was actually reasonably safe, and then the two-pack was really toxic and dangerous. But of course, because you think the cellulose is okay, then people didn't really wear masks properly and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, and that can bring on an awful lot of, you know, sort of damage to yourself and injury and whatever. So I think it's the same with all of that stuff. I think you need to be aware of what the risks are and then just be careful or sensible about that. But it doesn't need to get in the way of the enjoyment and stuff. But I think there are just some moments, especially with the electric stuff, where you just need to, if you're going to fiddle around with bits, you just need to make it safe first, and then you're okay. And then, like, you know, the cool thing is, in some respects, that a lot of it's now, once you've got it all together, a lot of it's software-based, but equally that sometimes removes some of the fun for some people. So it's an interesting world, but I think the nice thing, even if you do electrify a classic car, you've still got all of the other bits of the classic car that are going to go wrong like they used to. So you're still going to have lots of fiddly, greasy, oily stuff to get really, you know, sort of elbow deep in. So I think it's just part of the mix going forward. And I think the acceleration, the speed, you know, the and also actually it's a very visceral feeling. I mean, it's difficult if you were to convert a V8. You know, I think that, you know, the sound of that, especially I had a Lamborghini years ago from the show, and that had a flat plane V8, which sounds particularly lovely, especially in the Dolomite Mountains or whatever. You know, so it's a very special thing. So I think there are some cars where it's just not going to work, and even if you could replace that the sort of the silence with a speaker with a synthesized sound, and games, you know, games engines and stuff do that all day long. So it's not like it's impossible technology wise, but there's something missing. It's the deep throb. But then maybe you just don't mess with those cars. Maybe run them on hydrogen instead, or, you know, some other solution. But I think there's still plenty of stuff to learn, plenty of fun to be had, I think.
One of the things that's electric car people always talk about is that some cars are built to be electric cars, and some cars are just electrified. And how are cars that have been that are normal petrol cars and that have been electrified? How do they drive?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think if you talk about OEM stuff, like sort of new manufacturing stuff, I mean, I think you can tell the difference sometimes. I think, you know, the weight of the batteries and you know, the cool thing about something like a Tesla, you know, and then like the, you know, sort of the i3 and all those sort of things, those sort of cars, obviously, you effectively end up with a skateboard. So all the weight of the batteries is in the floor, and it couldn't get much lower. And it means that the central gravity of those cars is generally lower than it would be in a standard sort of car, or even a converted, you know, if it is just a petrol Golf that's just got, you know, had some electrification put in, then I think that's going to be different. And I know Volkswagen are making their new platform, you know, where they are. I think everybody's going to go to that kind of skateboard sort of idea, because it makes practical sense. It makes the cabin space better. It makes it easier to control the crash zones and all that sort of thing. You know, so again, even just practically, electric makes so much more sense. If you look under, I mean, like just seeing my Range Rover now in bits, you know, there are boxes and boxes of parts, thousands of parts to go to make the engine, and loads of little bits just to try and mitigate the bad, you know, this bit or that, or get rid of that problem. With electric, you know, it is very simple. I mean, okay, there's electronics, but essentially you've got, you know, sort of a motor, which is a, you know, like a whole, like a solid outer bit and a spinny inner bit, you know, and then there's sort of a couple of things to control that, and then circuit boards or whatever it was, and then really everything else is just like a conventional car. So there's just less parts to go wrong. And because of that, you can, it's also more easy to play with the package. So I think older models of cars that have been converted by the manufacturers, I think that you'll probably find they maybe roll a little bit more, or they sort of handle slightly more wallowy perhaps, even if they have compensated with suspension. The stuff dedicated to the job, I think, are much better than most normal, you know, sort of internal combustion engine vehicles. And then when it comes to classics, obviously it's quite tough. I mean, like with the Range Rover, I actually think it's going to be quite, it's relatively easy with the package to deal with, because it's such a big, heavy vehicle. I've got plenty of space and plenty of, you know, weight to compensate, you know, or to absorb the, you know, the where the battery space is going to be. But whereas something like a Fiat 500 or a Mini, that's a lot harder, because of course there isn't really any space for any of it to go anywhere. So I'm playing around with the Mini project very slowly, and that's one of the issues. I think, you know, some of the, I would like to put the batteries in the boot, but actually, again, for safety reasons, that's probably not so clever. So I'm still working on that one, and I think you have to watch this space for that as well. But I think generally classics can be made to work or perform at least as well.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hopefully better than when they came out of the factory, even if they're now electric.
You electrified the Maserati on the Wheelie Dealer show some years ago. How was that car driving?
That was great, actually. And I think the only shame of it is we couldn't get them, trying to upgrade the rear shocks, and we didn't get them to the show in time, so they took a bit longer to make than we hoped. And so you can see on one of the, when we do the test drive, that it squats a little bit too readily. But other than that, it was brilliant. I mean, it was faster than the original car. You know, the acceleration was better. And it was so much quieter. There's something really interesting about that, because you think that if you haven't got the engine noise, then there's not much to listen to, but you can actually hear the tyres, and you can hear sort of, in a way, almost subconsciously, more of the dynamics of the car. So I think it's actually, I'd be really intrigued to know the difference for like a Formula E driver versus a Formula One driver and how they respond. Because obviously when you're driving a car, it's not just looking through the windscreen and knowing where the road is going and steering accordingly. It's, you know, you feel that in there, you feel that in your butt, you feel it, you know, sort of in your, you know, your body is moving around, you feel the vibrations, you can change, you can hear or feel the difference in the road surface. And somehow that's sort of amplified in an electric car. And also, as I say, sometimes it's just really with our boat. It's just wonderful not having an engine, you know, sort of making all this noise. You can actually hear nature. You can hear the water lapping, and ultimately, that's kind of why you're there. So, it's. I think all of those are really good plus points. And as I say, you could always put a speaker over the top if you really wanted to.
Clearly, you have a fascination and a passion for electric cars. What kind of models have you driven that you actually that you especially liked? What are the best electric cars you've driven?
Well, I haven't driven enough, I have to say. I think I've had to go in a couple of the different Teslas, and they're, you know, great. I mean, I love what Elon's doing. Anyway, it's just the sheer belligerence of just changing the world market in vehicles for one thing, and then of course then there's little space projects as well and stuff. So, you know, he's a proper go-getter, and I think, and I like the way he's just said this can be done and then gone ahead and done it. I think it's a real shame. I'd love to have had a go in Dyson's I suppose now defunct car, because I mean it looked like it was really going in the right direction. And then I've sort of had a go in like a little i3 and stuff, and they're great fun. Sort of the Nissan Leaf is, you know, it's actually, again, surprisingly sort of, it's got some quite pleasant performance considering the kind of market sector that it's in. So I think there's rarely a bad electric car in a way. I mean, I think the things like you've got the Twizy and stuff, and that's great fun. It's just mad, actually. So, you know, there's a whole range, and I think I want to try more and more of them. I haven't had a go in the iPace or whatever yet, and some of the more conventional stuff. So it'd be good to have a go and just compare them all. I've just been doing some sort of van reviews, and there's a couple of electric vans in that lot. And, you know, again, that's where it gets difficult because, of course, they have to do many, many miles, you know, with loads and stuff. And so they're only just coming. And obviously our electric experience that we've done, you know, for the ice cream van, it's downfall at the moment is the range. You know, it's acceleration and sort of top speeds all there. It's just the fact that we can't go far enough. So that's, for a while, going to be an issue, and that's where the hydrogen comes in. But I think, you know, that, but even the Tesla Roadster was fantastic fun. Again, that was the first time I got to go really, really crazy fast, but in a, you know, again, with this silent car, and it's got a kind of a turbine on that particular model, so it's sort of on the motor, it was like air cooled, and so that added, it made it feel a bit Jetsons, which was quite nice, you know, so a bit futuristic, but from the 50s. So I think the trick is with all of these things, if you're making a decision about buying one of these cars, is to obviously go and do a test drive, but actually get out there and spend some time, or even hire one. We hired a Tesla from Oslo Airport, and unfortunately somebody hadn't bothered to plug it in before, so we got to a house, you know, with almost no energy left. And we were first when we were filming in the revival, actually, and over a couple of days, we didn't have much time between sort of filming jobs. So we ended up, I think, 2 miles range, I think it was. And so that was a little bit difficult. So, you know, you are worried about the range thing then. But on the whole, obviously, the fact that you can do 300 miles, I mean, most people don't ever do that in a day of driving. So, you know, I think the trick is to have a go and enjoy, find the one you enjoy, find the one that makes you excited, and I think they're aimed for that.
In the book, you're writing a lot of starting to work on Volkswagens, and immediately electrifying a Volkswagen T3 springs to mind as a good idea. But why the fascination for Volkswagens?
To be honest, I mean, it kind of happened by accident. My first car, I was looking for something interesting, and I hadn't really, you know, although I was aware of Volkswagens and stuff, and our next door neighbor had a beach buggy when I was a kid, and so I guess they were around in my head. My uncle had a camper van for a while as well, so kind of I was aware of them, but I never really thought about what I actually wanted for a car. And there was this Jeep that looked really exciting, wanted to go down to the beach, so it was fantastic, so we tried to buy that and couldn't. And then the next best thing that seemed to be in the paper at the time was this bright yellow Beetle, and really it was more, unfortunately, you know, it broke down quite early on, and so I then had to learn how to fix them, and then I took that to an extreme, and then you realise the brilliant thing about Volkswagens, or Beetles particularly, is that they haven't changed much in their main components, even from the 60s up right through to sort of the 80s, so you end up with all the bits being interchangeable pretty much. So you could put in like a late engine and an early car, or the other way around, or you could do different gearboxes or whatever. And there were, in the early days on the Mark 1 Golf, there was still a brake pipe that came from the Beetle. There's lots of interchangeability. And for me, that was brilliant because I could really start messing around. And if you go to the scrapyard, you know you could get your parts. So they were easy to get hold of, bits easy to work on, and everything was relatively cheap. So I guess that's, sort of got me first, but then also I think just by its very nature, people, they're very easy to personalize, so I think that's something that's more lacking these days. I'm sure you could put a vinyl wrap on a car, but you know, it's like with a bug, you know, with those Baja bugs, and you know, with sort of with the, you know, a lift kit in it, and with the engine showing out the back, and all these kind of cut down wings so they could go up into the desert, beach buggies, you know, like the cow look, you know, there was just, you know, the sort of retro stuff nowadays. I mean, there's just a whole gamut of sort of different ways of expressing yourself, and so I think I found that particularly interesting, and sort of took to an end in many different directions.
Yeah, because you're a fan of individualizing your car, or like making it something that reflects who you are. If I understand correctly.
Yeah, well, I think so, and I think. I think, certainly we look at the Comfy Banana stuff, all the vehicles we used to make. We obviously like the sofa we did just because I could. I just wanted to see if I could build a car that was nothing like a car, but still be street legal, still comply with all the rules. And we're very lucky in the UK that we have this rule book. And as long as you comply with all the rules in that rule book, and or you can argue your case, then you can get it on the road. And I know it's very different for you guys in Norway. And I feel for you, frankly, because it's, you know, it's brilliant to be able to. I mean, it was quite fun when we took the sofa to America last year. We drove from LA, well, to Vegas, and then up to San Francisco and back. It was about 12,000 miles, 1,200 miles, even. Which is still a long way in a sofa, frankly. It was brilliant. The police just didn't know what to say, because, of course, in America, you do get also to build all kinds of crazy hot rods. Depending on what state you're in, you can do some great, really mad stuff to cars. And I think it's just really fun being able to do that. And it's a shame that a lot of other countries don't adopt that. Because in a way, it's like art on the road, art on wheels. And so art, you can... And I think, again, like with my craft design technology course when I was at school, just the idea of having an idea, thinking about it, getting on with it, building it, and then going and testing it, you know, that immediacy is just really, really fun. And I guess I'm slightly impatient.
Yeah. For like 15 years, because you started school and were building, you've been building since you were like 12 or 13, 14 years, if I gather this correctly. And in your late 20s, you get the gig for Wheeler Dealers, and you spent almost 15 years being the, what if I can, the best way to put it is like the automotive mechanic teacher for pretty much the whole world. How did you end up in Wheeler Dealers in the first place?
Yeah, well, it's one of those things. It's quite random. I'd done because of the sofa, we had I'd been spotted, I guess. Well, it was one of those weird things. I think there was BBC execs were trying to make a show. I think you guys had Scrappy Challenge in Norway, but it was this kind of idea about making cars out of something, or making things or cars do stuff that they wouldn't normally do. And they were looking for someone to be able to do that. And as it happened, at the moment they were looking, we'd just done the speed record at Donington. We had been in the paper, we'd been in Custom Car Magazine, we'd been in all these different places. So I was the guy they needed to get hold of. And so they got hold of, we did the pilot, and it was really good fun. And then we ended up doing a series for that. So that was the series, one of my first TV series. And it was literally just because I used to mess around with cars. And of course, all those years of tinkering in the garage suddenly sort of paid off, and it was fantastic fun. And then some guys were sort of, actually just left the BBC, so I guess they must have known of me, had this idea for Wheeler Dealers, and it was actually called Grand Autos, which was its working title, because they were going to be done for £1,000 a grand, and of course they were grand in their way. So they were looking around, and they'd sort of found Mike, and they were then looking for someone else, and I had to do an interview, and I didn't, I almost didn't go, because we were busy building crazy vehicles, the office and the giant shopping trolley at the time. And it just happened that I had to pick up a part literally 10 minutes from where they wanted me to go on the same day. So I was like, you know what, I'll just pop in just for a laugh. And so I had to talk about my welding mask. I had like a solar-powered welding mask and I had to explain some bits and pieces on the Land Rover. And then I just forgot about it, to be honest. And sort of a couple of weeks later or months later or whatever, they phoned up and said, oh, can we come down and just do some more filming? I was like, okay, fine. So we just walked around my car as if, you know, it's just been bought. And then there was an instant chemistry. And so that, and then so they went, let's give it a go. And obviously the channel liked it. But at the time, of course, it was a tiny channel, a tiny show on a tiny channel. But it just kept getting better and better. The audience kept expanding. And I guess whatever we were doing seemed to work. And it was really the first of its kind of that sort of show. And there was a sort of a calm and a peace about it. And we weren't shouting and whatever. And by this time, the Americans had started doing all those sort of shouty shows. And it sort of somehow stood out on its own like that. And I think a couple of years, well, 10, 15 years ago, whatever, some time ago, somebody worked out there was like 35 other car shows that were sort of based on our original sort of thread. So it's quite a homage, you know, and it's got quite a lovely thing that we were able to start that. And it was great fun. I got to play with some really great cars. And the best bit is, you know, you think, oh, I've got to have one of those cars. I'm like the Lotus Esprit for me, or the DeLorean, you know, sort of like the Bond Bug, all these cars, you know, I really would love to get one of those. And of course, I had it for a couple of weeks in the workshop, and then I knew straight away that I never wanted to see one again, you know, for whatever reason. Or I managed to sort of scratch that itch. You know, so many people end up with, you know, massive car collections but never drive any of them. But I actually kind of did the other way around. I did all the work, did the hard stuff, got to drive it, got to have fun with it. And then, you know, sometimes it was a real shame to sell them. And other times you kind of did, you know, you're sort of glad that it's gone. You've had to have a play, you know, because I don't fit in a DeLorean, so I couldn't really own one for any length of time because I would just cripple myself. And the same with the Lotus. The only way I could drive it was by taking the driver's seat out. Which isn't brilliant. So, you know, so there's all those. So you find all that stuff out. And then really the most interesting thing for me is exploring. If you think about all cars, all car manufacturers solve the same problems in different ways. But it's all based on the same kind of automotive DNA. And that was the best bit. It's just understanding how, you know, Citroën will solve a problem completely differently to the way Porsche might or the way Volkswagen might. So it's that was really, really interesting. And I've learned an awful lot from that. So I then reapply that into whatever I'm tinkering with in the workshop.
And how many cars did you work on during your time on Wheelie Dealers?
Yeah, it was 135. Which is enough, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lot of cars. It amazes me that they've made 135 cars when you think about it, but different models. But
the crazy thing was, we barely even scratched the surface. You know, I mean, because I think of all the different models of all the ones we did do, but then there's all the variations and all the other ones in the stable. So, I mean, that was the thing we always found really surprising. I think is, you know, every season we then sort of already start. Well, certainly what used to happen is when we're doing the test drives, there's a lot of waiting around at the side of the road, waiting for the traffic to clear or the cameraman to be ready for his next shot. And then so there's not a lot of time to have a conversation about what, you know, what cars we haven't done and what we should do next. And we always tried to make the next year, you know, even better than the previous one. And it was amazing. There was never, ever a shortage of vehicles that would be great to do, you know. And because you'd done one, or we tried something a bit interesting. So when we did the Ampi car, or we did the, you know, the 110-year-old car, the Darak, the 1930 Darak, you know, for the London to Brighton run, all these sort of vehicles were a little bit different, a little bit strange. And it meant, well, actually, now we've done that, we can do this. And so you'd be surprised, actually, that there are, I think the world is full.
Yeah, because
cars that need work, but also that are interesting for their own life.
Yeah, because you started out with quite normal cars and quite normal budgets. I remember, I think it's the first season you repair, which is now a rather rare car, but a Ford... I think they were called Capri in Norway, but a Capri with and I think you spray painted with a spray can to repair it and stuff. And later in the seasons, you do full on restorations. So the budgets must have increased quite quickly.
Well, it started out I can't remember how many years. It was, you know, series one was £1,000. We had to be able to buy and do up the car within £1,000, hence the grand bit, I guess. And then went up to £2,000 for the second series, three for the third, and it sort of progressed that way. I mean, obviously, we had a tiny bit of budget extra, if you like, for the production, just to do some of the bits that you were never going to see on the show, you know, because, of course, the cars... And that was one of the hardest bits, actually, about making the show at all, was that in the first series, because we'd never done anything before, we just did the job. You know, we did change the starter motor or fix the hole in the exhaust or whatever, and that was fine. But then by the second season, it was like, well, we've done that before. We did that last year. So then we had to then try and sort of change the jobs. And so I then sort of, I guess, made a bit of a rod for our own back. And as much as I wanted every single job to be different to anyone we'd ever done before, so even if you're doing the brakes again, there's a different aspect, a different way of approaching it, perhaps. And of course, by the time we got to 135, that was getting really, really hard to do. And I think, you know, there's so a lot of what ended up happening is we buy a car with 20 things wrong with it just to be able to do the four that we wanted to film on camera. And then, of course, the quality. I mean, that's the other thing. We went from standard definition television to a high definition television. So suddenly we had to do a much better job of cleaning them before we filmed the last shot or whatever. And then it went to 4K as well. We were the first show to go on to 4K in Discovery. And that was terrifying because you can see stuff you can't even see with your own eye almost with 4K cameras. And so we had to just do a really amazing job every time. And of course, it was a huge team effort to make that happen. You know, and I mean, it was great fun with the crew. We had lots of jokes because you spend your whole time in this box, you know, sort of in this sort of quite pressurized situation. So of course, the humour gets a bit sideways. You know, gets a bit tricky sometimes. But it's it was always great fun and great jokes. It was just like, I suppose it's the same thing as a bit like being in the military or being in hospital or something. You know, where you have that kind of slightly warped kind of humour, and that was definitely us. But it was good fun, and then we got to go to some amazing places. You know, some incredible venues and stuff, and got to drive some great cars. So it's, you know, it's not bad as a sort of, you can't really call it a job, but it was a good time. But obviously, good things come to an end, I suppose. So that was that.
Yeah, because you enjoyed your time with Wheeler Dealers.
Very much so. Yeah, it's a really interesting. I mean, it's really hard work. But I think the nice thing was that the feedback you get from the audience. You know, we've got some really, really dedicated fans, and I think it's really very humbling, actually, when they come up and sort of talk to you about their projects, and you know, we've inspired. I mean, it's funny, I was in Norway about one Christmas, and we were picking someone up, and I got out of the car, and this chap in a scooter pulled up and was asking for directions. And of course, I didn't, you know, he started in Norwegian, and I had no idea what he was saying. And then he went, "Oh, it's you." And then he said, "Oh, I started this project because of you, and I think I'm going to get hit in a minute now." You know, but actually, you know, our show gave him the confidence to actually start a project for a start, and then actually to carry on. And I think that's a really amazing thing. We never sort of really set out to do that. It was just, can we just restore a car and do whatever? But I suppose as time's gone on, you know, we try to explain everything properly, and if we're doing something slightly dodgy, then we'd explain why, and how, why we're saving money or time or whatever for that reason. And it's amazing the number of people who say these little top tips have been really helpful to them. So I've been very lucky that I got to do that.
Yeah, I think that's true for a lot of people in Norway, at least. I know it's true for me because I've said the early seasons inspired me to work on my own cars, not because I wanted to, but because I was a student and broke. But yeah. Your shows inspired me, in example, to go and buy some cheap tools and fix the things I had to fix. And from there on, I managed to believe him and that this was something I could do. My English is deteriorating rapidly while I'm talking now, so sorry about that. But
that's good. It's better than my Norwegian still, which is embarrassing because my wife's Norwegian.
Yeah. I have to ask you, for the listeners who have watched the shows of the year, there's a guy always helping you out, and many believe that that's just some random guy working on the production, but he's actually a friend of yours.
Yeah, Paul. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was funny. We built stuff, and I think we, in the book I've actually included a couple of pictures from of us looking embarrassing, frankly, from, you know, from I guess the 90s. But it was I met Paul years and years ago. I was doing I had a T3 van, and I was putting a V8 Rover V8 into the back. As you do, and I needed a distributor, and there was like an early version of the distributor with a smaller. It was just smaller in design, so it didn't fit into the space because I had very little room at all. I'd actually lowered it so I could push the whole engine and gearbox and stuff forward in the van without ruining the angles on the CV joints and stuff. So it was quite technical, but quite difficult anyway. And I went to this shop I used to go and get a bit from, and they said, "Oh no, we've never had anything like that." But the guy around the corner will, and I was like, "All right." So I went to go and see him. and knocked on the door. As you can see, there's a guy there with his big drag car. He had his sort of a TR7 or TRV8 sort of drag car in this bright yellow, Ferrari yellow colour. And he rummaged around in a box and he had exactly what I was looking for. It was like, fantastic. And went back, fitted it. It didn't work at all. And it's like, how dare you? So I went back and it's like, well, what the hell is this about? And then he said, oh, come and give you a hand. And it turned out that for drag racing, he'd removed the mechanical advance for welding up the bob weights. We had some spare bob weights. So, and then it literally, we started working on stuff and tinkering with things together. And it went from there. And he worked with me for years with the Comfy Banana cars. And we built all kinds of crazy, like the big yellow, there's like a clamshell car we built called Robomo. Again, he built the engine on that, the Rover V8. So that was his thing. And the engine still runs sweet. I've still got the car and it runs beautifully still to this day. I've, you know, no maintenance at all. It's amazing. So, yeah, so it's been great. And, it was, and then when Wheeler Dealers started, it was sort of, he worked with me on Panic Mechanic, which is the show before. So, and we, you know, we even broke in one night to try and finish a car, you know, sort of just sort of sweet talk the security a little bit and went back and pretended we had to go and pick up some bits and it just didn't leave and just get some extra work done. So, you know, we've been through some mad times together, and then Wheeler Dealers was just an extension of that. And of course, as more cars are doing, the company Discovery wanted more and more episodes. We had to do, you know, work. We started off just six cars or episodes at a time, really. Once a year, and that was enough, and then you could have a bit of a break and get on with something else and then come back. And then, of course, as the show got more and more successful, they wanted more and more episodes. So we did 20, was the most I think we did in a year, and that was just crazy. And then Paul was joined by another guy called Phil, and so then both of them would be on camera every once in a while. And then Paul's son joined to help as sort of like, well, as Paul's assistant, but usually off camera. You know, so it's one of those things. It just the team effort got bigger and bigger. But Paul's right. He's working on some other car shows, I think, in the background at the moment. We've been talking about doing some other bits together, sort of going forward. So it should be interesting. So again, keep watching this space, see what happens. We should get him back on camera for sure.
Because you were saying everything has to end, and for a lot of your fans, your departure from Wheeler Dealers came as a shock. Are you happy about the decision to leave the show and what you've been doing since?
It was absolutely the right time. And I think, you know, I've got to do some amazing stuff since, which I couldn't have done. I looked after my mother for 6 months, which I could never have done if we'd been away filming somewhere. You know, we've got to do all those little things that I've been meaning to do for ages that sort of you just put off because you're working all the time. So that's been great. And I think it's, and again, the electric thing, it took me 6 years to persuade the show to let us do an electric conversion. And then we finally did when we got to the States because they weren't so worried about it. So I never would have been able to go as deep into that as I have done with the ice cream van and stuff. So it's been, you know, it's one of those things. I mean, like, normally, if you're at a job for longer than about 10 years, you're expected to leave or move on or get promoted or something. So I thought, you know, so from that point of view, it was the right time. But also, there are so many other things to do. So that was really the thing. I'm sort of just getting on with that now, which is great.
Yeah, because I have to ask, are you on good terms with your co-presenter, Mike Brewer, still?
Well, he's so busy. He's over in the States filming because, of course, he's kind of gone over there. And, you know, like when we were filming before, you know, we didn't really see that much of each other, to be honest, other than when we were actually on camera together. So now, you know, he's just doing his thing over there, as busy as a busy thing. So I think it's the nature of television is that you kind of waft in and out of these things, and it's super intense while you're doing it, and then, you know, you go off and sort of go and pursue other things. So I guess that's the way it's always going to be, really.
So you're doing the ice cream van project, but are you, and you're thinking about building an electric Range Rover, but what cars do you own today? You've got two Range Rovers and a battery electric ice cream van. What else?
Well, exactly. Well, I have the two Range Rovers because it doubles the chances of one of them working. but I've also got the, I bought the Cadillac that we did on the show. As you might remember, we had a 1916 Cadillac that we were going to go on Repeating to Paris with. And then we had to buy a 1918 to use some of its bits for the show. So I ended up sort of buying those off the show. So I've got those now. Well, actually, we own them anyway, or half of them anyway. It's complicated, but we have those to do up. And I've, the 18 unfortunately isn't working at the second because it needs a few little jobs to make the starter charge. It's the world's first electric starter sort of in production. and it's 100 years old, and it's obviously stopped working. So that's going to be fun to try and work out, you know, so how to get that to work, whether it's the magnets are sort of, you know, sort of worn out or something, or you know, or windings melted, I'm not quite sure. But, you know, so there's a bit of tinkering to be done there, and then they're fantastic cars. I mean, the 16 needs a lot of work to get it ready to be on the road, but the 18 is pretty much there. So they're great fun. And, of course, I've got a lot of the weird stuff. So we have the sofa, which is currently in the States. We've got... you know, like a bed car and a few other crazy things like that. I'm like an outspan orange, driving orange as you do. So we've got those sort of things as well. But literally beyond that, at the moment, we've got nothing else. We sold a couple of classics we had to sell before when we got dragged out to America, just because, you know, it was safer than just leaving them somewhere. It's one of the things, I think I'm quite lucky that because I've played with so many, worked on so many cars, as I was saying earlier, you scratch that itch. So I don't really have any desire to have a massive car collection because I know how much work that is. I think, you know, because you've got to keep it working. Like, someone like Jay Leno, for example, he's got this massive, massive warehouse full of amazing cars, and every single one of them turns on the button. It's absolutely amazing. But he has four full-time guys working for him, you know, to make that possible. And he goes and tinkers, you know, when he can, because he's always working as well. So I think the thing is, it is... Any car collection is a lot of work. Even if you don't do it yourself, you're going to have to pay someone else to do so, and you've got to store them, and you've got to look after them. So as a custodian of these things for the next generation, I guess it's one of those things where I think I'm happy with tinkering with the stuff I've got right this second. And I've got a couple of ideas for projects I'd like to make going forwards, but I guess we'll have to just wait to see what the YouTube does and see what, you know, see how crazy I get to go.
So is Jay Leno working on his own cars?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he knows how, I mean, that's his fascination. You know, he knows how they all work. You know, he tinkers with them all. I mean, he's been an integral part of building them. For years he was trying to get hold of a steam powered car that Chrysler made back in the day, and they wouldn't sell it to him and stuff. And so in the end, he built his own. So he let him and a team designed and built this thing, went and did a world record with it, I think, and then they ended up getting the other one from Chrysler anyway because they were in a bit of financial trouble. So he's now got two steam cars. No, he's actually got three because he's actually got the other one, which it was Howard Hughes sort of commissioned, and it's just the most amazing bit of engineering, and it still works. You can turn it on, even though it's steam, it's ready in so many of those few minutes. It's an incredible thing.
Yeah, because he's got one of those crazy jet engine. I think it's a Chrysler from the 50s.
Yes, that's it. Oh, that was it. And so so that was, yeah, the gas turbine thing as well. So yeah, that's the thing. He's just fascinated with that. So that's his toy box. So, you know, like, he works, you know, does his stand up and does his other bits and pieces just to pay for the car collection. So that's what I'm saying. You know, like, if you've got a lot of cars, it's going to cost you one way or the other. I think there's going to be a couple. I think if you can do fun stuff with them, so, I mean, I still have a hankering for a veteran car, so a car that's older than 1904, and because then we get to do the London to Brighton one, and that's an amazing, you know, every year, even if it's peeing down with rain, it doesn't matter, it's fantastic fun. And I'd recommend, even if, you know, if you ever find yourself in the UK, it's always the first Sunday of November. I think even this year they're still hoping to try and pull it off. You know, you just have all these 100-year-old cars, all these people dressed in tweed and stuff, and there's steam and smoke and whatever. It's just the most amazing thing. It feels like Edwardian Britain. And so for that reason, I feel I'm allowed to have one of those cars one day, perhaps. And you know, there's like my, it'd be nice to maybe track down my uncle's Bentley, perhaps, you know, maybe one day in the future. But, you know, I think, you know, it'd be crazy having 365 cars. You could drive a new one every day. You know, that would be nuts. So I think it's nice to appreciate what you've got, but, you know, keep it simple.
Mm. But you were over filming with Jay Leno and the sofa, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What did Jay Leno think about your sofa, by the way?
No, I think, well, he was very kind. I think there's an episode just gone out last week, actually, in America with that on CNBC. But it was good fun, actually. It was a nice day out, if you like, sort of chatting. And he took to driving it really easily as well. I mean, I guess, again, because he's used to driving so many different things, I guess that really helps. But it is also automatic. But, I mean, I think he quite enjoyed it. And I think you are very exposed. You know, so driving through the desert, obviously, if there's a sandstorm, you're going to get it. But equally, when you're going down the strip at Las Vegas, you know, it's a mad place at the best of times, with lots of people at different
times having all kinds of fun. So there's a lot of funny comments and stuff, but obviously because he used to doing stand-up, he had a line for everybody, so that was great. So I think he had a good time. And I think he did suggest that I should try designing or building a normal car just to see if I can.
We have to, we're starting to come to the end of the interview, but I have to ask you, if you were not necessarily young, but you wanted to start out your new hobby of building or repairing cars, what's your best tips to get started with working on cars or other stuff you want to build? How do you get going? How do you get the confidence?
I think if, say it's a car, I mean, because it could be anything, but if it's a car, I would first of all find a car that you like the most passionate you can be about. I mean, because obviously it doesn't have to be a car, that you if it's something you want to afford, obviously you need to make sure that you don't max yourself out when you buy it. But also it's got to be something that, even in the really hard times, you're still going to be pulled through. Because obviously working on stuff like that can be frustrating. You're going to have high times as much as low times. And obviously, putting on the shiny new wheels and whatever and polishing the glass, that's the easy bit. It's all the really tough stuff where there can be some enjoyment, but obviously sometimes, you just sort of get through it. So I think you need to make sure that it's something you're really definitely passionate about rather than, you quite like it. But also, I would join a club if you can find, if you can find a club that's specific to that car, that's even better, because there'll be loads of advice and people who've already been through what you've been through. But also, it's really about learning those top tips and also just having the fraternity, if you like, of a lot of like-minded people. And then you can go on trips together and stuff, or you can even go in someone else's vehicle that's finished, so you get to inspire yourself. That's what we used to do on the show. It's just, this is what you could have, so let's get on with it and whatever. So, but I think also, it's quite daunting. If you're just starting, I think just a car that's pretty much there, pretty much up together would be a place to go, because there's always going to be stuff that needs tinkering. I think you don't want to go and buy like we did with the 1916 Cadillac. You don't want to buy just a load of rust, basically, a couple of boxes of bits, because that is tough. That's really daunting. And, but if you get a project that you feel is insurmountable, you just have to break it down into smaller and smaller and smaller jobs. And then that way, if it's literally just undo a bolt and then repair it and sort of clean it up and put it back on again, then suddenly that's quite manageable. And once you've done that one thing, it's easy to do the next thing. So I think that's always the way. And also, don't be scared to sort of have a go, but at the same time, make sure you're prepared, make sure you've read about it, make sure you understand the implications of what you're about to do and the safety issues and stuff like that. Like if you're going to undo some springs, make sure that you're doing it properly, but also get a friend to help you, because that's part of the fun, because obviously then you can have some banter while you're going on it, but also you've got someone like Paul to give you a hand, because that is also invaluable. And then it comes to things like tools. You don't need to go and rush out, although it's really tempting, to go down and sort of go down to Biltim or whatever and go and buy a massive set of tools or whatever. You don't need to do that. I think you just buy the essential. And how I learnt with the Beetle, my first car, my parents had played with Minis, so they had Imperial tools. So I learned very quickly that using the wrong tool for the job is very stupid, and it can hurt, and you end up with lots of blood everywhere. But literally, just buy the tools you need as and when you need them. I still have one of my first tools, which is this special 13mm spanner with a funny cranked end, so I can actually get to a carburetor on a Volkswagen engine. Because the back nut, the one that's next to the fire, the cooling tin, is... the fan shroud is actually very difficult to get at, so you need this special spanner. But then also, the other thing is, I wouldn't ever be scared. I remember it was early on, but I think you'd be confident enough that if you have to modify a tool to get a job done, that it's okay. Maybe go and buy a cheaper one. And there's plenty of really cheap tools out there that aren't actually so bad in quality. You don't have to go and buy your Snap-on or your Mac tools straight away. But equally, things like a really, really lovely ratchet, if it's a bit more expensive than you're expecting, it's kind of worth its weight in gold, because you'll be using it all the time. Whereas, the set of slightly shorter spanners that go with the ones that are longer and even shorter, you might not need them, but there'll be that time when you must have them just to get the job done. So I would not buy that stuff until you really, really need it. I think it's one of those things, you just ease yourself in, but really get people around you, because that's where it's most fun. And then you can go off on trips, and you can go to car shows and stuff, but it's what will pull you through the difficult times, I think, really.
So follow the progression of the wheelie dealers seasons. Yeah, is what you're saying.
Exactly. That. And you don't you don't need a ramp and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, you can if you can find someone where you can borrow one every once in a while, that's helpful. And you know you should use it at, you know sort of actual stands or wheel or actual stands or wheel stands or whatever when they're using trolley jacks and all that kind of stuff. So, but also, you know, secondhand tools are fine too, and you can get some amazing bargains where somebody else is. You know, now finished with that, or you know, sort of a company's going bust or whatever, you'll find stuff out there. So there's always, you know, there's always ways of finding it, and that's quite fun going to auto jumbles and then buying those odd tools and bits and pieces while you're getting other spares. So I think that's the thing. Make all of it a fun. Make all of it an adventure. I mean, we're very lucky over here because we have a Bewley. They have some massive, massive auto jumbles twice a year. And so you could just spend literally 3 days traipsing around fields looking at tables for the rusty old parts, and you'll suddenly find that one bit that you need for your car, and also a load of stuff you really didn't need, but you'll buy anyway. So that's where the fun is, right?
Thank you so much for your time. For our listeners who want to get your book, the easiest way is probably going into greasejunkie.com and ordering it there, and you have a lot of other stuff like t-shirts and gloves and stuff like that, and to follow your channel on YouTube for further stuff, is that correct?
That's absolutely, yes, it's youtube.com/edchina, two D's of course, and in fact you can actually on the edchina.com website there's even a little button that you can click to subscribe straight away, and as I say, I do promise we will have some more YouTube videos sometime in the near future, so it's almost worth waiting for it, so
Again, thank you so much for your time and have a lovely summer. Ja, det var det. Da har vi lært dette og hint om vår britiske favorittmekaniker. Vi kommer til å gi vekk et signert eksemplar av boken til Ed China, så følg med på vår Facebook-gruppe Finansavisen Motor for muligheten til å vinne denne boken. Den har jeg lest. Det gikk vel kanskje gjennom igjen I intervjuet, men den absolutt verdt å lese. Den gir et fascinerende innblikk også I mannens liv utenom Wheelie Dealer-programmet. Vi skal som sagt ha flere gjester når sommeren over, så vi ønsker jo selvfølgelig tips om gode stemmer som kan komme inn her og prate med oss. Vi skal også være på, skal man si, kan man si at man på luften, Caroline? Men vi I hvert fall på luften I hele sommer. Vi har episoder gjennom sommeren, og håper jo at dere vil følge oss da. Og har dere tips til episoder, temaer, biler, personer, historier dere ønsker at vi skal ta opp, så send oss en mail på miletermil@finansavisen.no. Og med det så ønsker jeg dere en ypperlig sommer.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mil etter mil, en podcast om bil, en podcast fra Finansavisen. Programledere Håkon Sæbø og David Kordahl Andersen. Produsent Lars Brenden Skram. Og ansvarlig redaktør Trygve Hegnar.